Have you ever had to relearn something? You ever had to relearn something? Like, of course you can. It's kind of a silly question. Of course you can. It's part of being human. We are constantly learning and relearning even the things that we thought we knew and we thought we had completely figured out. Often we find ourselves relearning these things. For example, last Sunday, when I did the announcements, I talked about ways that you could volunteer, just like Sarah did for us this morning. And I said, hey, if you're interested in volunteering, send us an email to welcome@westheights.org. And I thought, hey, that email address works. I set it up myself. There's no problem here. Within a few minutes of the service being over, some of you said, hey, we tried to do that, and the email bounced right back. It seems that thing that I was sure that I knew how to do, I didn't actually know how to do, and so I went and I investigated, and I couldn't figure it out, so I called Sarah because, well, Sarah knows how to do almost everything already, and I said, Sarah, can you figure this out? And within a few minutes, she had it figured out, and what I learned is the thing that I thought I knew how to do really well, I don't, and now I have to learn how to do that all over again. And so what is something that you have had to relearn? It could be something as silly, perhaps, as relearning a piece of technology that you thought you had mastered, whether it's resetting that flashing clock on the microwave or the stove every time the power goes out. I have to relearn how to do that one every time. Or it could be as complex as finding out that what we once thought was true about a relationship is, in fact, not. Relearning is just a part of life. And it's also a part of our story as followers of Jesus. See, what happens as we grow is that we might find ourselves rethinking things that we never thought we would rethink. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. As much as it can be an uncomfortable process, you know, God is a really big God, and it's kind of naive to think we have them all figured out. And so relearning is a part of what it means to follow Jesus. Last week, Terry, sitting down in front this morning, enjoying the posture of not being the one speaking, right? Last week, Terry Ween spoke, and it was an excellent message, and so if you missed it, let me just refer you to the podcast or find the video posted on our YouTube channel. It was an excellent message. I would highly recommend it. One of the things that Terry pointed out was how the parables of Jesus might make us feel uncomfortable because they can challenge some of the things that we've assumed or believe about God and what it means to follow him. And this was certainly true for those listening to Jesus, particularly the religious leaders. I mean, these were the folks who studied Scripture. They had strong opinions about what mattered and what was right and what was wrong. And as Jesus begins to talk, he starts to push back against their assumptions and against their beliefs. And you know what? As we spend time getting to know Jesus and studying his life and his teachings, we shouldn't be surprised if there are moments when we think that we're being challenged, where we have to rethink and relearn things that we just assumed to be true. This morning, we're going to look at three parables that come from Luke chapter 15. And I'm calling these parables the parables of the lost stuff. Sarah laughed at me when I made that the sermon title, the parables of the lost stuff. But it kind of makes sense because in all of these parables, something goes missing. And they form an important part of Jesus' teaching to people who might be tempted to think, hey, you know what, I got God figured out. And so we're going to be looking at Luke chapter 15. And I'm going to start by just reading the first two verses. Now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear Jesus. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and he eats with them." Now the reason why Jesus will end up telling the parables that he does is that there's some of the religious folks who are watching Jesus, and they're in just the complete and utter disbelief that Jesus hangs out with the people that he does. I mean, they look at who Jesus is hanging out with, and they see tax collectors, and they see people called sinners, and they're like, whoa, what's going on here? Tax collectors were folks who had betrayed their own people. They were working for the enemy. They were collecting taxes for the big, bad Roman Empire, and they were known for their willingness to rip people off in order to pad their own pockets. And so we might understand why these folks might not be so popular, right? Why you might not want to talk to them at parties. They're kind of, you know, they're kind of jerks. And then in addition to these tax collector folks, the religious leaders had this category of people that they called sinners. And these were the people who were considered immoral because they were either unable or unwilling to follow the rules, the way that the religious leaders thought that they ought to follow the rules. Now, because the religious leaders believed what they did about God, they had a rule that they were not to associate with those type of people. But here is Jesus, and he's willing to sit down and to eat with these folks. And eating with these folks that does not equate to separation. Actually, it communicates acceptance and a desire to know and to be known, even to folks that with folks that maybe we might be tempted to say, oh, are they really worthy of being accepted? I mean, hey, if we sit down and eat with them, does that somehow communicate that we are condoning their actions? But Jesus sits down and he eats with them. And Jesus is the embodiment of the God who is love. And God's love is not limited by the morality of others or the wrongs that somebody may have committed or their position within a dominant society or anything else like that. And through these parables, Jesus is inviting us to relearn what we thought we knew about God and to notice how God is quick to go to those who don't fit our picture of what a good person might look like. Now, we've said this before, but loving others is a statement that I think most of us here would say, yes, we're supposed to affirm that. That's a good thing. But we should give some thought to what that really means. What does this mean when it comes to people that we see as being criminals? Or how about those that we see as being racist? Or even somebody who has caused us harm? How does that we ought to love others or loving others is a good thing fit with these folks? Just yesterday, I was out on a trip with my family, and I saw somebody wearing a hat with a slogan on it that I don't agree with. And I found myself saying under my breath, what a moron. And then I caught myself. I caught myself and realized what was my gut response was to write them off. And I found myself saying, like, how does God's love apply to that situation with that person who's wearing or representing that thing that has such a visceral response inside of me? See, as we grow in our understanding of God's love, we find ourselves feeling uncomfortable about what it means. Either because it means that we need to love somebody that we don't want to, or we catch ourselves feeling off guard by our own responses and how it doesn't match up to the God who is love. The religious leaders of Jesus' day were caught off guard by God's love. And so unpack this, Jesus tells three parables. And this morning we're only going to read two of them, but we will talk about the third one briefly at the end of our time. So I'm going to continue reading from verse 3 in Luke chapter 15. Then Jesus told them this parable. Suppose one of you has 100 sheep and loses one of them. Doesn't he leave the 99 in the open country and go after the lost sheep until he finds it? And when he finds it, he joyfully puts it on his shoulders and goes home. Then he calls his friends and his neighbors together and says, Rejoice with me, I have found my lost sheep. I tell you that in the same way, there will be more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who do not need to repent. Or suppose a woman has 10 silver coins and loses one. Doesn't she light a lamp, sweep the house, and search carefully until she finds it? And when she finds it, she calls her friends and neighbors together and says, Rejoice with me, I have found my lost coin. In the same way, I tell you, there is rejoicing in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents. Now, both of these parables tell a similar story, and that is that God's love doesn't wait for us, it goes to us. God's love doesn't wait for us, it goes to us. In the case of the first parable, it's a sheep that has wandered off and has gotten lost. One sheep out of a flock of 100. And to some folks, this might just be the cost of doing business. But in this parable, Jesus depicts the shepherd leaving the 99 to go and seek and rescue the one. Now, does this mean that the shepherd cared for the lost sheep more than the others? No. But what we see is that the shepherd's love for the lost sheep does not change just because that sheep went missing. Or how about how that sheep caused their own problems by being a bad sheep and was an inconvenience to the shepherd? How about that? Again, this shepherd we don't see acting out of obligation, as in this is my job, and if it wasn't my job, I wouldn't be going out there and rescuing that sheep. But there's a genuine love that is expressed in the joy and celebration of finding that one lost sheep. As a kid, I remember going to my friend Joel's house and watching him dig through the couch cushions and finding a loonie that had fallen out of his dad's pocket. At that time, that seemed like a whole whack load of money. In fact, it seemed like Joel's dad always had a lot of change in his pockets when he sat in this couch, because almost every time we went over, if he needed money to go to the store or something, Joel just dug through the couch cushions to find whatever we needed. Now, I'm not going to lie, when I read the parable of the lost coin, there's a little part of me that thinks about my friend Joel and how he would find these coins that clearly were not that important to his dad. I mean, if they were important, his dad would have taken better care of them, right? But the parable of the lost coin is not about something that doesn't matter. Rather, that one coin represented a significant portion of this woman's savings. It represented one day's wage, and she only had 10 of these things stored up. And so what would you do if you only had a few days worth of savings stored up and suddenly 10% of your savings just disappeared? You would probably do what this woman did, and you'd turn your house upside down to find it. And when you did find it, the relief would lead to celebration. Well, these are the two scenes that Jesus uses to talk about God's love and God's care: a missing sheep and a missing coin. And what's interesting about these stories is that in neither of these stories, is there something malicious that has happened to cause these events. Life happened. Animals wander off. Small coins get misplaced. They fall into couch cushions. And in neither of these stories are the lost objects able to return on their own. The sheep is helpless, and the coin can't find itself. You know, I think that this would have described some of the folks listening to Jesus and maybe some of us. See, these folks weren't necessarily evil people, but they were lost in the sense that they were without the direction of God. Either because of their own choices or the choices of others or even just life circumstances, they were without direction. And the religious leaders, they made it worse by looking at them with judgment and self-righteousness and piling on all these religious expectations that they told the people were necessary if they stood a chance of being accepted by God. And nobody could live up to that. But what Jesus does here in this story is he tells a story about God's pursuing love. That God doesn't wait for people like us to get our acts together, but he finds us wherever we are, in whatever state we are in, and he rescues. Imagine the impact that would have had on those people who were considered sinners. You know, they've been told their whole lives that they were not welcomed by God, and then Jesus says, hey, this isn't how it works. You know, that God has never stopped loving them. They've been told their whole lives that they needed to do all these right things in order for God to accept them, for God to want anything to do with them, but that Jesus tells them that God isn't standing back and waiting, but his love is pursuing those who are lost. And for some of us this morning, that's what we need to hear. You know, for us, we identify with these folks that have been called sinners, either by the choices we have made or the circumstances of life or because of what other people have done to us. We find ourselves feeling lost, wandering aimlessly, in need of direction and meaning, and we just can't seem to find it in all these different places and things that we try. And we wonder that if God really wants anything to do with us. And what Jesus wants us to hear is that God's love is for us, even in moments when we feel like we are far from God. See, this parable tells us that God's love comes to us where we are at, in whatever circumstance we find ourselves in. Now, for others of us, we need to pay attention to how Jesus ends these parables. You know, Jesus ends both of them by talking about rejoicing in heaven when somebody who was a sinner responds to God's love. You know, we could read this as simply a description of a heavenly party of sorts, I suppose, but I think Jesus is telling his listeners, particularly those who are prone to being judgmental, he's telling about this heavenly party because he wants them to relearn what they have assumed God is about. He wants them to see that the kingdom of God is eager to welcome people in, and that celebration is a character trait of the kingdom. See, through this parable, Jesus invites us to set aside our judgmental tendencies and to embrace the kingdom values of welcome and celebration. As a kid, I can remember having these conversations with my parents. My parents are awesome. But just the other day, Michelle and I were talking about how in my house, you didn't really get punishments or consequences so much as a conversation, which was almost worse. Let's talk about it, okay? was almost worse. Sometimes you'd be like, just send me to my room, please. No, but we talked about it. And I often these conversations, I got to a point where I was like, Dad, I already know this. Like, we've talked about this so much. We've already know this. And it's funny is at this stage of parenthood, I'm already getting that little voice saying, Dad, I already know this. We've talked about this already. You know, if we were to keep reading in Luke chapter 15, we would read another parable that sort of sounds like what we've just read already. It's another story about something that was lost being found in another party. And we might imagine that those listening to Jesus might have that thought to themselves, goodness, we've already talked about this. Why are we talking about this again? But there's something about this story that is different from the parables of the lost coin and the lost sheep. That this story is called the parable of the lost son, or the parable of the prodigal son. And we aren't going to read it this morning, but I'm going to suggest that we take some time later on today or this week to read it over. But in telling this story, Jesus continues to invite us to relearn what we thought we knew about God, perhaps because some of the assumptions that we have about God are so entrenched in us that we need to hear the same point made over and over and over again. We need to hear it three times. Why might this be? Well, for some of us, you know, our view of God is that he's judgmental, and he's just sitting up there waiting for us to screw up, and then he's going to get us. Or we think that God is all about the rules. He got all these rules here. He must be all about the rules. He's pretty stick. He's pretty strict, and he's a stickler for all these details. Or if we do believe that God is loving, we have in mind that his love has conditions to it, and that love is really for somebody else. It's not really for me. And these beliefs not only shape how we relate to God ourselves, but they become a part of how we relate to others. We can become judgmental. We can withhold acceptance and love, and we can hold people to impossibly high standards and things like that. But Jesus doesn't want us to think about God like that, and so he tells a third story about a son that leaves his father. Now, what stands out about this parable is that the lost object, the son, is someone who has clearly done something wrong. In the previous story, the sheep wanders off and the coin is misplaced. There's nothing really malicious there, it's just life. But here we have somebody who clearly made some bad decisions, and there are people in this story who think that he should have to live with the results. In this parable, there is a son who demands his inheritance from his father. And the thing about an inheritance is something that usually comes after somebody dies. And so by demanding it, this son is saying to his dad, hey, Dad, you're better off to me. You're more useful to me if you were dead than you are alive. It's a selfish, hateful demand. But the father obliges, and the son goes on to waste his wealth on wild living, which is an intentionally vague term that allows us to insert maybe our own temptations and what we might do in similar circumstances. But in time, the son has nothing left. He's desperate. And he wakes up to the reality that, you know what, life would be better if I was again living with my father. And so he turns back in shame, desperately hoping that his father would accept him. But his expectation is that his father won't. Now, as a bit of an aside here, this parable gives us an interesting way of thinking about our own relationship with God. You know, we can find ourselves thinking and acting like we don't need God. Maybe even that we don't want anything to do with God. Like, life would be better off if we just kind of left God over here and we went and did our own thing. And for a while, things might seemingly be going okay. But then one day we might wake up to the reality that things aren't going the way that we had hoped. Perhaps there's an empty feeling that we just can't shake, like there's something missing. And we might feel shame in that moment and afraid that God won't accept us. And if this is you, this parable is for you. See, the father in Jesus' story is not someone who responded to his son's rejection by turning his back on his son. Instead, we see a man who's gotten over the we see a man who's not gotten over the loss of a son, nor is he harboring bitterness. He is waiting and he's hoping that one day his son will return. And when his son shows up as a dot far off on the horizon, this father gets up and runs out to meet him, wrapping his arms around him and welcoming him back into the family, and immediately throws a party. And it's Jesus' hope that this picture of a loving father would start to generate inside of us an idea of what God is like in his posture towards us. Now, there's another son in this parable, the older brother. And if we are not careful, we can find ourselves being a lot like the older brother. See, the older brother, he noticed the things that his brother had done wrong, as well as how it had broken his father's heart. And what had grown in him is a callousness towards his brother that has caused him to not be able to see the love that his father continued to have for his brother, even though his brother was not at home. And this callousness, it was keeping him from seeing the joy of the moment, the joy of his father when his brother arrived. Instead, he thinks that his brother ought to deal with the consequences of his actions, forever being on the outside of this family. Now, in many ways, this describes the religious leader of Jesus' day. See, in their minds, they were doing everything right, and therefore anything good that came from God belonged to people like them. And those bad people, well, they should get what's coming to them. They don't deserve any of the good stuff. But in this parable, Jesus is inviting his listeners who struggle with being judgmental. He's inviting them, he's inviting us to be freed of that and to embrace a posture of welcome and celebration. I mean, if the father isn't holding a grudge, why should the brother? Now, as we wrap up our teaching time this morning, I want to pull out three things that perhaps we need to relearn. The first thing is that God's love is for us. You know, the truth is that many of us recognize our own imperfections quite easily. And if that isn't bad enough, we have people in our lives that seem to enjoy pointing that out to us, our imperfections out to us. And then add to that perhaps our perceptions of God can sometimes gravitate towards a view of God that sees him as angry and judgmental, especially in light of our self-admitted imperfections. The end result is that we can easily find ourselves thinking that God is not interested in us, or that we need to get our act together in order for God to accept us. Well, this morning we are invited to allow these parables of Jesus to dismantle that kind of belief and that kind of understanding, and to hear Jesus describing what God's love for us is like. That God's love does not wait for us, that God's love is seeking, it's rescuing, it meets us when we are lost and stuck, and that like that father runs out to his son, and that God meets us where we are at when we are full of shame and when we have nothing to offer. See, God's love is for us. And for some of us this morning, that is what we need to hear. And you can tune out of the rest of the message because that's the thing that you need to sit with this morning. For the rest of us, we're going to continue on listening. Our second point is that God's love is for others. Again, this is one of those things that if we've been around church long enough, we know that we're supposed to check that box. We're supposed to affirm that. But again, have we ever really thought about what that means? I mean, it's easy for us to think about God's love being for our family or even for the neighbors that we like, but what about the other people? Let's face it, there are people in our lives and in our world that if we're being honest, we don't want to see them benefit from God's love. We don't want to see good things happen to them. We may even want to see bad things happen to them. And the idea that God's love is for them, that might be hard. But Jesus invites us to recognize that God's love is not just for the people that we think are good enough. And actually to release ourselves from the temptation to feel like we need to be the judge and to be the one who determines who is worthy. There's freedom in this. See, to follow Jesus is to allow the Spirit to replace our callous, judgmental hearts with the welcoming heart of Jesus. Last point is to learn how to celebrate. Learn to celebrate. Three times in Luke 15, Jesus invites his listeners to take on the kingdom trait of welcoming the lost and to celebrate their return. And I think this repetition should cause us to pause and ask ourselves, what does this mean? See, what Jesus is doing is he's inviting us to exchange our disposition of being judgmental for a spirit of celebration, because celebration is a kingdom value. It's a part of the kingdom of God. Now, this could be as simple as parents, you know, taking joy in those little conversations that we have with our kids when they spontaneously ask a question or say something that makes us realize that they're thinking about God and what does it mean to please Him. And I say this knowing that those conversations always happen at bedtime when they're supposed to be going asleep. And what we want to do is we want to just push them to sleep. But celebration in that moment is to pause and to take joy in it and to enter into the fact that their little minds are firing and they're contemplating God's love. And what does that mean? Or maybe as a house church, it could be making a point to identify how we see God at work in the lives of the people in our group. It could be saying like, hey, Terry, you've been telling the story about this problem going on at work, and we are just noticing how you seem to be handling it with grace and with love and with patience, and we see God at work in you during that difficult situation. That's one way that we celebrate. Or it can look like setting aside our skepticism, choosing to set aside our skepticism, being willing to explore how God may be inviting somebody to experience His love. I remember a couple years ago, and this is a negative illustration, but I'm learning from my mistakes. Maybe you can too. I remember a couple years ago, there was somebody that came to church. They were sitting in the back, and that Sunday, we happened to talk about baptism, and they indicated that they wanted to be baptized, and what went through my head was, why on earth would somebody who's never been here before want us to baptize them? Is there something going on? And my skeptical, inquisitive brain started asking questions and trying to come up with scenarios about what this person was really doing. And in the process, kind of lost track of this person, and I pushed them away. You know, a better response would have been to recognize that despite this person's prickly demeanor, that perhaps God was at work in that situation, inviting this individual to experience His life-changing love. And I wonder how things would have been different if I'd been able to set aside my skepticism in that moment. Folks, these parables, particularly the parable of the prodigal son, are ones that we might be very familiar with. The challenge is to not allow the familiarity to keep us from being challenged by Jesus, to relearn things that perhaps we thought we'd already figured out, and to be challenged by what does God's love look like? What does it look like for us? What does it look like in our relationships with others?